Episode 1219, A Nuanced View on AI.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono. We are back.
We're back. Are we still in kooky Christmas season, or are we out of that?
Well, so here's what happened with kooky Christmas. I do have an episode.
One more episode.
I'm going to do, and it involves Nazis, UFOs, Antarctica, and the Hollow Earth.
Wow.
But I have to read a book for it.
Okay.
And I thought I could just do a little poking around. And I realized, nope, I got to read a book for it. So,
wow.
I'm sorry, everyone.
So the book? So have you started the book?
I did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, started the book. So I'm committing to do this episode, but I'm not committing to win.
That's Kooky Cupid. Or is going to have to be Kooky Cupid. We did this before
maybe
one time.
Kooky Easter Bunny. We'll see.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll see when I get to it.
Not Kooky de Mayo.
I got a lot going on these days. Kooky de Mayo is amazing. I like that. I got a lot going on. I'm not finding as much time as I would like for some of this stuff. But I did find time for this episode, which is the Nuanced View on AI.
That's right.
What did we call it in the poll? You put out this poll.
Yeah, so in December we did the listener choice poll, and the choices were why confession is important, why did we start doing listener feedback on the Sci-Fi Christian again, and number three, this is the one that won, why did Ben start using AI? And that's a short way of asking that question, but the bigger way is he yelled at us for 3 years. about not using AI, and now he's using it. Why?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm using it that much. I think of people like I'm not, you know. Let me actually start there, and then this episode's. Let's start there.
Okay.
So, like a lot of people, I am in a profession where I do need to be aware of what's going on technically. In part because I run a technology department.
As do I, but go on.
Yes, we basically have the same job. So there is a need I have professionally to be aware of what some of is going on and be conversant with it. And I think that we need to... This is the world we live in. That said, I think that as I've thought about AI... over the last few years since we began this conversation, if we rewind, it really begins with ChatGPT. It doesn't come out, but it comes out with kind of its big moment at the end of 2023 or 2022, whenever that was, 2023-ish. And it's like, holy smokes, this is a brand new thing. And at the time, it feels like a watershed moment. It feels like, you know, the next big technological leap has just shown up. And I think that looking at that, there was a lot that I was looking at the time and saying, I'm concerned about what this means. I'm concerned about the way that we're just all blindly diving into this without thought. And I would say that every concern that I had at the time remains. Meaning that I'm still concerned about the way that we are diving into it. I'm still concerned about what our usage of it is saying about us, especially from an aesthetic perspective and AI, so-called AI art, or the way that we are eroding ourselves, by losing skills by offloading them to AI, especially writing. I think that the writing stuff is extraordinarily concerning, especially in an academic context. And then people are losing the ability to write because you can just have AI do it. So the farming your thinking out to machines, to use a Frank Herbert ism, is still something I'm very concerned about. But the situation a few years later is different in a couple of different ways. And I think that it requires us to maybe relook at this just a little bit. In particular, and I've mentioned this example a number of times, it didn't take long for marketing departments to realize that AI was the next big thing. And what happened then? Well, what happened was AI started to be used as a label for everything including things that had existed for a very, very long time. We were just doing our Dante episode tonight, and if you don't listen to those, we have an edition of Dante that has a bilingual edition, meaning that the English translation is on the right-hand page and the Italian is on the left-hand page. And we were playing around some with Google Translate tonight. Well, that's a form of AI, and it's existed for a lot longer than 2023. You know, it's better now, as it will continue to get better in the future, but that's an AI that I and others have used for 10 plus years, 15 years, something like that. You know, Google Translate, and you know, before that, good old Babelfish back in the day got me through my college Spanish classes. Not well, but it got me through my college Spanish classes back in my undergraduate days. So, you know, you have, but all that stuff is being labeled AI. I have a book on my shelf that I've owned for about 6 years because my technical background before I moved into management is in data work. And so I have a book on data analytics about machine learning. Well, everything machine learning is now called AI, even though that's a concept of data analytics that's existed for a very long time. So you have that going on, this relabeling, this broadening of the label to everything. And you also have, I think, the thing that, you know, while my concerns haven't changed, maybe the nuance part of it that's changed a little bit is that I don't think I appreciated at the time, back when we first started this conversation, just how pernicious the hype cycle around this was. And what I mean by that is a couple of different things. Number one, just like there's a bunch of stuff that was relabeled as AI, the hype cycle at the time told us this is a brand new thing that just showed up. And it's not. Like, I read this book, AI Snake Oil, and it did a really good job of showing that this isn't a brand new technology. This is a technology that has been evolving really for decades at this point. Obviously, that doesn't mean that there aren't significant changes that have occurred, but this isn't like something that just showed up yesterday. But the hype cycle tells us that it is. And then the hype cycle also says, and this is what I really was guilty of getting sucked in to early on, is that, you know, AI is going to transform the world. And in 5 months, none of you will have jobs. I'm exaggerating, but not really, not by a lot. Like, you can, you know, the hype cycle is out there. And it's really, really hard to determine what's real with that. And so, you know, because you have these companies like OpenAI that are not making money, like, there's no ROI that they've been able to show on this. And so, you know, how do they get more funding? Well, they get more funding by, like, this is the next big thing.
Wait, are they not making money because they're a nonprofit?
No, they're not a nonprofit. They're a for-profit company.
Okay, so they're saying that why are they not making money?
AI doesn't make money. Like, this is the thing.
I thought that they partnered with, like, Microsoft as an example. I'm sure Microsoft is paying them something.
Yeah, I mean, they're making money through funding, but they're not making money through the product. AI is not giving a return on investment.
I mean, they sell subscriptions, so I don't think I understand what you're saying, that they're not making money. Like, you could buy a subscription.
If you look at their revenue models,
yeah,
OpenAI and other AI companies are not making money.
I guess if you're saying how much...
They have revenue, but they're not turning a profit.
Yeah, I get what you're saying now. How much they're putting into it, they're not breaking even.
Not even close. Yeah. And the projections are not good for the future.
Okay, I hear
you. So how do you get more funding then? Like, because if I'm funding you as an investor, I want a return on my money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is your company giving a profit that will give me a return on my money? No. Well, then why should I give you more money? Because if you give me more money, then I'm going to have the next big AI that's just going to, you know, really blow up the world, hopefully metaphorically. You know, so there's this hype cycle out there. And within all of this, the other big problem that you have is these shifting definitions. Like, we've talked about artificial general intelligence a number of times here. Like, that's the one that could be the Terminator, but maybe not. Like, people use that term AGI. Nobody agrees exactly on what the definition of it is.
Yeah, in the past it would have been something like the Turing test.
Yeah,
and I think at this point, I think there are studies that have shown.
Yeah, the Turing test is not the yeah.
The Turing test is a test that you correct me where I'm wrong on this. It was come up, I think this guy came up with it in the 50s, Alan Turing, and he was saying something.
That's the one.
He was saying something like, if AI can mimic a human so well that a different human is unable to tell that it's an AI, they've now passed the test of having some sort of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Or artificial general intelligence.
Well, thanks to boomers on Facebook, AI passes the Turing test every single day. Like that,
I think we're way past
it. But yeah,
it,
we are. The Turing test is...
It's been passed.
It's been passed.
Yeah.
But it
used to mean that does it now have sentence?
Exactly.
And that's not what it means.
And so there's that whole conversation. So we arrive at a position where like these fundamental concerns that I was talking about a few years ago are still there. Art, like erosion of yourself, the future, all this stuff. But the definition that we've been talking about them in this context, this definition of AI, has gotten too slippery. It doesn't, it's become a meaningless term, right? Like you use things just by the fact that you have a computer open in front of you and a phone next to you. You have used products that are labeled AI today. Every single day. So is everyone else who uses any form of technology. So the problem is the definition of AI is too broad. And this is great because let's come back to those concerns. Because the other problem I have and the other thing that I've changed is to say that our definition of AI is too broad, but it's also too narrow. What I mean by that is that those concerns, if we say those are problems with the AI, we're thinking too narrowly. Those are problems with technology and how we think about ourselves in the modern world. So what I actually want to do in this episode is flank the topic of AI. Right? AI.
Push it to the side?
No.
Flank?
Like flanking it.
What does that mean?
That's a military maneuver.
No, I haven't been in the military.
It's a tricky one.
So it means you get closer to it?
No, it's like you're sneaking up on the side. We're going to flank it. Just.
I'll hang with you.
Let Google's AI tell you about it or something.
Let me just quickly ask ChatGPT what that means.
Exactly. So it doesn't mean that I'm like now, you know, biggest fan of AI, but it does mean that I think that we need to go back to a more fundamental view. The issue isn't AI, the issue is technology, and we need to think about technology from the ground up. And through doing that, we can arrive at what do we do, not just with AI, but with everything else. So I want to think about technology, period. Okay? And what I'm going to do in this episode is walk us through a number of questions. And they're not exhaustive, and some of these probably could be topics in and of themselves. But the overarching question on this is, I want us to ask ourselves, again, this isn't about AI, it's not even about computers. What cost has technology extracted from you? What does it cost to use technology for you as an individual and for us as a people, as a culture? What do I mean by that? Like, we tend to think of the new technology comes along and it's neutral. Like, oh, I'll sign up for a Facebook account. That sounds fun. Okay. And maybe it was fun. And there's a cost to it. We've seen how social media has rewired an entire generation. Not for the better. Was that cost worth it? You said something really astute when we were talking about books in a previous episode. And I don't remember what it was and what episode it was, but you said, you know, I don't have time to read, meaning physically read. And then you stopped yourself and you said, no, that's not true. I choose not to, which I'm not trying to pick on you because it's more than just you. Like, that's a really astute observation. You choose not to. There's a cost. Who paid that cost? Well, how did that cost come in? Well, it came in when we all collectively decided to get these phones. And what we did is we introduced a lot of benefit into our lives. Like, I have a teenage driver, and I can pull up my phone and I can see where she's at. And I really am grateful for that benefit. And there's a cost. I and everyone else have rewired our brains, killed our attention span. There's cost as a species, as I've used the example of the refrigerator. Let's go back to that technology. The refrigerator has a benefit. You can keep your food cold, and there's a cost, meaning that it has rewired how we interact as a people. You don't have to go shopping every day. Now you can go shopping once a week. And now, because you can go shopping once a week, you can have both people in the workforce. Maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad. Like, the cost doesn't mean don't pay it. It doesn't mean let's all now lament every technological innovation, but it does mean that what we've done now since the dawn of the modern era is we've accepted technological advancement after technological advancement. We've always said, isn't that neat? Isn't that great? But what we have failed to do is stop and think about what the cost of those things is and what the impact of it is. I've mentioned this book a number of times, Against the Machine by Paul Kingsnorth, and I want everyone to read it. And I hope, you know, at least audiobook it. But if you can't actually read it, just because it's a good exercise for you. But he has a section here. It's a little bit lengthy, but I want to read this because I really think it brings forth our current state of where we are in today. 100 years, 150 years, maybe 300 years, depending on when you want to chart the beginning of this problem of just accepting technology into our lives as a culture and as individuals without thinking about it. So it says, you are a citizen of the 2020s, device in hand, earbuds in, you wander the lanes of a strange world. You can make a trip to the shops without talking to another human being, but you cannot walk through a city without being filmed. You cannot walk on a beach without being filmed, for there are satellites now, so many satellites. You are never far from a screen. You cannot afford to be, and why would you want to? The screen gives. The screen has abolished time, distance, boredom, longing. Is anything you see on it real? But then what is reality? Who decides? Do you find this notion oppressive, restricting, then redefine it. Make anything real. Make everything new. Make yourself into what you want to be. The app is available to download. Robot bodies will soon fight wars. Robot brushes make art. Robot minds write sentences like this one. Babies will emerge from artificial wombs. Their mothers finally freed to work and consume and play in order that they may be fully liberated. Mother is such a problematic word, like home, like body, like God. Soon the farmers will be gone and the food will be made, not grown, and it will be boundless and formless, like your culture, like your very being. There is no form now. Everything is fluid. It flows and rolls on and through. The past is dead and at the same time was never real. There is nothing at all to tether you. All the chains are broken. There are codes to scan in order to access things which only yesterday you never knew you needed. Soon you will need to scan the codes to do anything at all. Soon your children will be taught STEM by an AI that will laugh at its jokes. The algorithm will know them better than you do. Soon a number will determine if you are on a list of the good people. Soon all the things will be universal, accessible to all, through the power of the network. Progress, kindness, openness, information, so much information. The information, maybe this is why everything is confusing, so overwhelming. The content overflows like stormwater from the drains and the downpipes. Too much information, too many films, too many books and channels and people and brands of shampoo. Everyone is arguing now. Did they used to argue this much? Why is the weather changing? There are microplastics in young mother's milk. Where did the snow go and the stars? Why are the children so unhappy? Sometimes when the evening comes, you can stand outside in the twilight and it can feel like everything is different, but you can never quite explain why. Is it in the air or is it in the way now that you taste it? When did it change? What changed exactly? You could just be imagining it. Perhaps you are thinking too much. Perhaps you are tired. Perhaps you're just losing your mind. But doesn't it feel as if quite recently everything has somehow shifted? Like, that's a convicting section because it really just drives home that you're living in a world that is unrecognizable to the rest of human history. And that has an impact on you. And if you're going to live in the world, and Paul Kingsnorth's solution, by the way, is not go sell everything and live in a cabin cut off from civilization. He's writing a book that was actually published, right? But it is to say, and we'll talk more about what he recommends as we go, but it is to say, like, stop just accepting all of this and start thinking through it. All of it. Not just ChatGPT. All of it. The problems we were talking about when we talked about ChatGPT started decades ago. Maybe a couple centuries ago. So the second question I have, or the first one, what cost has technology extracted from you? And that's really an overarching one for these next ones. What things did you used to love? This is the second question. What things did you used to love to do that have changed because of technology? And the reading thing's a perfect example of that. I'm in the same boat. You know, I have a commitment to myself in 2026 to read physical books. Read physical books because I've decided, and it's hard to find the time and it's hard to find the attention, but I've decided, and I'm not saying anybody else has to make this. None of these have right or wrong answers, but I want people to think through this. The goal of this episode is to make you intentional. And I've decided I intentionally don't want to lose that in my life. Not just, I still read on my Kindle. You know, I love reading on the Kindle. I loved reading the Paul Kinsnorth book there because I can highlight stuff and bring it here to share. I don't want to benefit that, but there's a cost to it. And the cost is there is something about that physical book. And I'm not ready to give that up. You know, are you? And what other things are like that? It doesn't even have to be books. Like, did you used to love watching movies and now you can't? Because the thought of sitting still for 2 hours without looking at your phone is unbearable. And when you try to do it, you just feel like your whole body's itching. What things did you love to do that you don't do anymore or do differently because of technology? Number three, how has technology affected your relationships? Like, how often, and by your relationships, and again, these questions don't have to be all bad. We've met people, you and I, because of technology.
That's right.
We've met people because of this podcast, and my life has been enriched by those relationships. And I know my kids see me staring at my phone way too much, and I hate that. And I hate that. And I know that I have been guilty again and again and again of retreating to my phone because I don't know how to connect with somebody. So technology has changed my relationships. Some good ways, some bad. There's a cost to all of it. Now, the good news with all these costs is that you can combat them, but you're going to have to be intentional about doing so. Number four, how has technology affected your worship? Here's a good test for you. How much technology does your church have? Scale of 1 to 10. Just think about that. And here's a really good one. When you walk into your sanctuary, assuming that you walk into your sanctuary, if you log into your sanctuary, you're on the wrong side of this issue already. What do you see? You just look straight ahead. So it used to be, like, there's a divide between Catholics and most Protestants here. Not all Protestants, but Catholics, you walk into the sanctuary, you look forward, what do you see? Well, you're going to see the tabernacle with the consecrated host. You're going to see the altar dead in front of you, right? Because the Eucharist is central to Catholic worship. A lot of Protestants, especially lower church Protestants, meaning less liturgical, you'll see the pulpit because the word is present, the preaching of the word. There's a solid theological debate to have there, right? But both are valuable. You know what you see in a lot of Protestant churches now? A screen. Like, think about that. Think about that. How damning is that? You don't see a cross. You don't see a pulpit. You don't see the Eucharist. You don't see any religious symbolism. You see a screen. And I think that if you're in a church that where you walk in and what you see, it's not irrelevant. What you see is technology. You're in a situation where you either need to actively be combating that in your church or you need to find a new church. Does your church regard online church as just as good? You need to be combating that or you need to find a new church. I think that everybody needs to evaluate. And no church is perfect. This isn't none of these are arguments for perfection. Again, it's just do some data gathering for yourself. How much technology is in your church? How do you evaluate that? You know, how many screens are there? Is online considered as good or close? A prominent church in our area, megachurch, Eaglebrook, I don't mind naming names, they just began an online-only campus. I think that's damning. I think they should be rebuked by their parishioners and by other pastors for doing that.
Say more about that. Why is that?
To reduce Christian worship, to say that Christian worship can be done online just as good as in person, I think is heretical. It denies what the church teaches about the body. It denies what the church, and I don't just mean the Catholic Church, I think you can get here with Protestant theology as well, teaches about the nature of worship and the Christian community. I think it's a heresy, and I think it should be treated as such. And I think if you're in a church that does that, you either need to confront it or get out. But regardless, even if you're not, the rest of us shouldn't pat ourselves on the back either. How much technology is in your worship? And how has it changed? And again, it doesn't have to be all bad. Most of us have like the Bible app on our phone. Okay, that's good. Like, that's a good thing. Most of us, maybe you have access to Christian podcasts, maybe even a sci-fi Christian podcast. Maybe there's good things there. I'm not saying technology has all been negative to your faith, but where's the cost? What cost are your churches paying? Right? Next one, and this really gets to, this is kind of the pivot one as we get into the next part of this. How has technology uprooted you? So Kings North spends a lot of time talking about roots. Let me actually set the table for this by getting to, sorry, I'm going through my highlights, but I have a lot of highlights in this.
You read through your highlights, and I'm just going to tease that I'm not letting Ben off the hook, listeners. Even though he's doing this good discussion, I'm still going to ask you some probing questions about your own AI use. So just prepare yourself for that.
Yeah. So he's talking about roots, meaning cultural roots. He says, no human culture has been anything but flawed. All lasting human culture and histories have been rooted. That is to say, they have been tied down by things more solid, timeless, and lasting than the day-to-day processes of the functioning of the personal desires of the individuals who inhabit them. Some of these solid things are human creations, cultural traditions, a sense of lineage and ancestry, ceremonies designed for worship or initiation. Others are non-human, the natural world in which those cultures dwell, or the divine force that they always, without fail, worship and communicate with in some form. We need those roots. We need a sense of belonging to something that is bigger than us, across time, both space and time, and we underestimate that need at our peril. So roots, those things that ground us as individuals, those ground us as humans, those things that go way back, those things that you didn't create, but you inherited. What we have right now is a culture, especially through technology, that is closer to an anti-culture. I was thinking about this. I spend a lot of time thinking about things I hate. And I was thinking about like how much I hate influencer speak. Hey guys, I just tried this new product and it's a total game changer. Like, there's all these sayings that are just, everybody says them. You hear like the same slogans and jargon, but they don't arise from anywhere. They're just this influencer culture, and they'll change overnight. They're not rooted. Memes are like the same thing. They're funny for a day, and then they're gone. There's no root to it. And, you know, what happens then when a culture begins to be overtaken by those? A generation understands culture with things that don't last more than 5 minutes, where the jokes of today will be gone tomorrow. Thankfully, some of them, like 6, 7, will fade into the distance. And as much as that makes me happy, I'll tell you what doesn't make me happy is that there's a generation that's their cultural joke, and it'll be gone. Because they live in a culture without roots. And then there's this monoculture where everything has to be the same. Right? There's no variation. There's no sense of localness. There's no sense of this works this way, and then you go somewhere else and it's weird. It's saying, no, the internet makes everything the same. I was watching the documentary Burden of Dreams last night, which is Louis Malle's documentary on Werner Herzog's filming of Fitzcarraldo. So Fitzcarraldo's filmed in the jungle, and Werner Herzog is a crazy person, and so it's great. And in this documentary, Werner Herzog's talking a lot about his working with the native population. And he's talking about how sad he is that they're not going to exist anymore. And they're going to be overrun by just the larger Western civilization that will roll through. And he has this quote that I stopped, and I'm making a point in 2026 not to double screen, but I did pull out my phone to write down this quote. He says, I don't want to live in a world where there are no lions anymore. Where there are no people who are like lions. They are like lions. Meaning this culture that is weird and has gross food and does things that make no sense to us. And the anti-culture, thanks to technology, is rolling through and flattening all of that. And we will live in a world without lions. And it'll be safe, but it won't be good. And then along with that, too, I was thinking a lot about deconstructionism. Deconstruction being this this thing that just wants to tear everything down. I have another quote from King's North I'm going to read, but you know, deconstructionism is really understandable, and it's something that the postmodern time has been very adamant about. We want to deconstruct everything. We want to dig into it, and we don't want to allow old power structures to exist. And it's like, we can understand why, because there's corruption everywhere, and we want to throw up the tables and turn things over and you know, not just do things because it's the way we've always done it. And like, there's this energy there. But what I think we're seeing with the deconstructionist project is that because it's deconstruction without any sense of roots and without any sense of preservation, that it's just destructive. So King's North says this about deconstructionism. He says, like many people, I spent a long time after the 2016 populist upheavals and the consequent counterreaction trying to understand what was going on. I'd had plenty of hints of it in my previous work, much of which had dug into the growing class and social chasms caused by globalization, but it was only when I came to see it through the lens of the culture of inversion that the swirling chaos around me started to make sense. And by culture of inversion, he's talking about the way that this deconstructionism wants to just turn everything over. So the goal isn't to build something new. It's to obliterate what's there because those systems are corrupt or wrong or rooted in whatever. I understood then why our new elites would loudly condemn Christianity for its patriarchy, hierarchy, and oppression while simultaneously singing the praises of Islam, a far more traditionalist and often oppressive faith. It wasn't that they cared for Islam. It was that Christianity was the founding faith of the West and it must be demolished. I understood why the new Star Wars films had to first humiliate and then kill off their white male hero, Luke Skywalker, and replace him with a young woman. I understood why the aspiring Prime Minister would publicly declare that the next actor to play James Bond, toxic masculine archetype of the British imperial state, should be female, and why every cultural commentator in Britain also insisted that the next Bond should be black. I understood why a white male BBC editor would stand before an audience of mostly similarly pale-skinned people and explain that nobody wants to hear white men explaining things anymore. I understood why people would topple statues of long-dead slave traders whilst filming the whole thing on smartphones made by actual living slaves. I understood decolonizing the curriculum and cis-heteronormativity and stale pale males and diversity training, and I understood all of it not as a desire for actual meaningful change, let alone as any kind of thought through pathway to a better world. Instead, I saw a great weave of symbolic meaning. I saw all of it as a rolling statement by those who controlled the levers of power in the post-Western West, a statement that said, we are the opposite of what we once were. We reject our ancestors and our legacy. We condemn our past and our history. We condemn our past and its legacy. We have redrawn our cosmic map, and we are now something entirely new, even if, as of this moment, we have no idea what. That's deconstructionism. It's like, topple it all over, replace it with nothing. Just be the opposite of what's there. You know what I was thinking about with this, especially in terms of a Christian example? Remember the emergent church?
Yes.
It's like the biggest thing ever.
The early 2000s?
Where is it now?
Yeah, we've talked about this before.
It's gone.
It's gone.
It's not just that it's not as popular. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right here in Minneapolis, we had a big center of it. Solomon's Porch was a big emergent church. It closed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist anymore.
And you've explained why, but do you want to explain it again?
Well, I'll explain it. There's probably a number of reasons, and it, for whatever reason, I'm fascinated by that topic. But at least one of them is the emergent church was a deconstructionist movement. I'd say really two things relevant to this. It was a deconstructionist and pro-technology movement. Meaning that we want to dismantle the old structures of the faith. Let's invent new ways of doing church because we think the old ways have gotten stale and lifeless. And then let's use technology to do church in new and exciting ways. And both those things happened. They dismantled the old, and those new ways were new and exciting for a little bit. And then those got less new and less exciting, and they were left with nothing.
You've talked about how a system like that doesn't count on raising the next generation in their beliefs. How have you explained it before?
Yeah,
How then it just goes away because there's no one believing it.
Exactly. This is the problem liberal Christianity has and the emergent church. And I broaden it out from just the liberal wing of the emergent church. Even like you look at the Mark Driscolls of the world, which the theology wasn't deconstructed, but the rest of it was, and the emphasis on technology, and most of that's gone too, or been subsumed back into more traditional church structures. But yeah, I mean, liberal Christianity says this probably isn't real, so don't worry about it. The current generation sticks with it. They bring their kids. Their kids have some legacy of, like, I go to church on Christmas and Easter because mom and dad used to take me, but I don't actually believe that. And then their kids don't go at all. The emergent church somehow, miraculously, did a speed run of what mainline Christianity has been doing for 100 years. They did it in a decade. It's just gone. And it's astonishing.
And I mean, what you've said to me before that stuck with me is the fact that the kids didn't grasp or didn't really make it their own because the leaders didn't take it seriously enough. And so then there is no one to continue the church as the next generation comes forward, and then it just goes away.
If I'm a pastor and I'm sitting there telling my congregation, Jesus was probably just a guy, and so none of the miracles are real, and he probably didn't get resurrected, and sin isn't real, and you don't need to worry about it, but we can still support each other.
Hell's not forever.
Exactly.
Or all of that. Or things like, you could just do church at your own home.
Exactly.
I'm not going back to what you said earlier about the online.
No, but it's part of it.
Early on, I remember, like, I think there is a difference. I'm not saying this against all home churches.
Yeah.
But there's different levels of seriousness or how serious people are taking their home church.
Yeah.
And if it's just your family and you just don't want to go to church,
100%.
It's not really a home church.
Exactly. But, yeah, but it also goes to the online church only thing. Like, that is a deconstructionist attitude. It says for 2,000 years, Christians have gathered together at a church. Ooh, but the people are the church. Shut up. Everybody knows that. I'm talking about, not talking about the church as the collective. I'm talking about the church building. People have gathered there for 2,000 years. Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, all of us. And when we say, because COVID hit, oh, you can just go online now, that is deconstructionist. And those people will, by and large, not entirely, but by and large, will leave the faith because of it.
So are you saying for a church that has a strictly online present, no, I shouldn't say strictly. Let's say that one of their campuses is an online church, like the church you mentioned earlier. You're saying those online campus goers won't be as serious about their faith as people.
I think most of them won't even be Christians in the not too distant future. It'll go the way of the emergent church.
And say again, why is that? Why don't you think
it's a deconstructionist movement? Like they are uprooting what made church church. They are uprooting. You now have Christians that are disconnected from the roots of Christianity. And I don't just mean the roots aren't just reading the Bible and good theology, right? They are the roots of how do Christians practice the faith physically. Not just physically, but including that. What are the traditions and the modes and the ways that Christians do church? We have roots. Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox. This is not a sectarian statement, right? Like, this has been everybody. I'm speaking for everybody. We have roots as a church. And when we say, just sit at home in front of your computer or your phone and watch, do church that way, and that's just as good, what we are telling people is, you don't need those roots. And that is a heresy. It's just wrong. So then the next set of questions then, what are you rooted in? Both you as an individual and you as a culture. What are you rooted in? And we really struggle with this. You know, yesterday was the feast of the baptism of the Lord. But today's an even better holiday. You know what it is?
Is it another feast?
It's National Clean Your Desk Day.
Okay.
I know most of those are goofy and whatever, but it's also kind of telling. Like, we chuck the liturgical calendar. The few things like Christmas and Easter that we've kept, we kind of wear them like we've hollowed them out. We wear them like a skin suit. You know, there's no meaning in them. They're completely divorced from their roots. And we've replaced it with new holidays, like Pride Month. That's a secular religious holiday. And we have things like that because we got rid of our roots. So what are you going to be rooted in? If that's your culture, what are you going to do? How are you going to root yourself better? So you need to think through that. You need to think through that on a really deep level. You need to think through that both your roots are cultural, religious, traditions, art. I loved the example that he gave in that quote of Star Wars because it really gets to it. Like, you know, the original trilogy, especially A New Hope, is the monomyth, the Joseph Campbell monomyth, right? The hero of a thousand faces. So, you know, this idea of the hero's journey. Oh, the hero's journey. It's trite and it's boring. Yeah, but it's also rooted in millennia of human history. That's roots. That is roots. And the sequel trilogy, as he points out, among many, many other problems with it, what's that rooted in? Well, the first one was rooted in nostalgia. So the roots go back 30 years. So we went from whatever flaws of dialogue and corny acting A New Hope had, it has them, but why does it resonate? Because it's rooted in millennia. Like, you couldn't get the monomyth out of your system if you tried. It is at the level of your DNA. It is that fundamental to who you are as a person. And we said, let's replace that with, remember Chewbacca? Remember the Millennium Falcon? And then the second one wasn't rooted at all. It was actively deconstructionist. So no wonder it failed. And I don't even know what was happening in the third movie. That was just rooted in the quest for more money or something. But you can see it's like, okay, there's lots of other, that's oversimplifying what went wrong with the trilogy, but that's a big part of it. It's a huge part of it. So you need to think through your roots. And then how do you want to deepen those roots for your children? I think that, yeah, obvious ones, going to church. But also, wouldn't it be good for your kids to see you read? That's something I want to try and do more of. My kids don't see me read. I read, my kids don't see me read. How do you want to deepen those roots with your children? How do you want to pass on? If you were passing on the culture and the way cultures used to pass that on, what would that look like? And what is your hierarchy of values? Not all values are created equal. So a lot of what we have, this starts to bring it back to technology. So let's come full circle now with this. So does all this mean technology is bad and evil? Not necessarily, but it means that you have to place technology within your hierarchy of virtues. Meaning that if you say, there are virtues to me having my phone, but there are also a lot of vices with it. How am I going to control that? Well, you're going to have to control that by having a strong hierarchy of virtues. Here's what I value. Here's what I believe. And here's how this does or doesn't fit into that. And you have to do that with every piece of technology, right? Like, I value the efficiency and access my phone gives me. But that value is subservient to other values that I have. Connection with my children, my love of reading, you know, my desire to have an attention span and be able to watch a movie. Like, that's, I'm talking about those things when it comes to values. So I value my phone less than I value those things. So there's a place for this device, but only if I'm making it subservient to those things. Figure out your hierarchy of values and then slot technology into them, all of them. And so your technology, you only use it if you can use it in a way that doesn't violate your hierarchy of values. And be thinking about that, okay? And then think about, where are your lines? What lines are you not going to cross? Are you going to put a chip in your head? No. Like, what things are just outside altogether? And only you can answer those questions for yourself. But that's where I think we have to approach not just AI, but technology as a whole. So I have no problem talking about what I haven't done. I've played around with Copilot. I use things like we talked about, the translate stuff. I've used the transcription services, all that stuff. So I would say with AI, here's what I would tell people with AI. Go ahead and use it. But first do that exercise of getting your roots and determining what your hierarchy of values are. So reuse it, but then as you use it, you need to be constantly evaluating yourself. Okay, I use ChatGPT. What impact did that have on the other things in my life I value? And if where it had a where it had a negative impact, can you mediate that? Can you pull that back? And if not, then you need to walk away. And I would say that for ChatGPT and for Copilot. I mean, Copilot sucks, so that's not a hard one to walk away from. I would say that for your phone, for your car, for your refrigerator, for anything. If that technology is violating your hierarchy of values and you can't pull it back, walk away. That's my nuanced view right now.
There it is. But after the music, I'm still going to ask you a few more questions. Right. But that was a definite ending. I had to hit the music. It would have felt wrong to not hit the music there. But
and everyone, please go read this book, Against the Machine by Paul Kingsnorth. Read it, read it, read it. You don't have to agree with every word. I don't agree with every word. But go and wrestle with it. It's going to help you do those two exercises, roots and values.
Well, listeners, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
And we are the Cyber Christians, and we are signing off.
All right.
All right, you ready to be on the hot seat?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question that was asked for this poll is, why did Ben start using AI? I'm going to start to answer it. You already did. I'm just going to summarize some things.
Okay.
So you stayed away from like the typical AI, like ChatGPT and Claude and those types of things for years. But then at work, it came up naturally that you had to be at least in the loop on AI. So
yeah.
So that's kind of the introductory answer to the question. You said at work you use Copilot. What kind of things do you use it for?
Well, it really failed at what I was trying to use it to combine several documents into one. I use it for things that I don't use it for anything. So this is a great question because it gets into a couple of what I am trying to form as my lines. I don't want to use Copilot for anything or any AI for anything that I feel like replaces my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm not going to use it to summarize emails. Asterisk, some people write, if somebody sends me a block of text that's completely unreadable, I reserve the right to make an exception for those. But I'm not going to use it to like write stuff for me or summarize for me. I want to do the hard work of doing that. But I don't mind using it for formatting, for some of that combining work, for some of those things. I also see a difference between, for me, I'm speaking as me, using it in my personal versus professional life.
Yeah, that's
trying
true.
To minimize yeah. more in my personal life. I'm trying to minimize technology as a whole more in my personal life. Well, I use it all the time professionally. And you know,
wait, you use it all the time
professionally. I'm the
like Copilot. You're in Copilot.
No, I technology.
Oh,
I use
sorry.
It all the time.
Yes, got
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Okay, so Copilot, but. You know, Copilot is powered by ChatGPT, but I get the sense you're not actually in ChatGPT.
Well,
or have you tried?
All ChatGPT is OpenAI's Copilot is Microsoft's version of that.
But it's literally like Copilot is the same model as ChatGPT,
yeah, but,
whereas Claude is Anthropic's own AI.
Yeah, but OpenAI, like if you go to ChatGPT, the model it's confusing, but the model and the product are different.
Yeah, I've heard that. Actually, I just saw a post about this. That like ChatGPT is a brand.
Yeah.
The model is ChatGPT 5.2.
So using ChatGPT on ChatGPT's website versus using Copilot are not the same.
Okay. Okay, so never use ChatGPT itself.
No, not yet.
Claude?
I likely, in the interest of full disclosure, we're in the process of standing up our own instance of ChatGPT.
Oh, like you're working with OpenAI. To have your own secure
not exactly,
version.
But yeah, there's a product called Microsoft Foundry that allows you to set this up. So we're working to do that. And
yeah.
So we'll have it. We just don't have it at work.
At my work also, there's things we can't use it for because we might have secure information.
Oh, totally. It's a DLP nightmare, data
right.
loss prevention.
So yeah, we're also exploring what kind of secure AI could we use? Who would it be powered by? One option we're looking at is powered through Anthropic's Claude. It would be
yeah.
similar to Claude, but it'd be like our own Claude as an example.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because the DLP stuff is a huge, huge, huge risk.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like I work for a bank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could be shut down.
Yeah.
Regulatory wise with stuff like that.
All right. So I know that you hate all the art and video making. So
I do.
I'm assuming you haven't used Sora or anything
no,
like that.
The most I've done with that is laugh at the Franklin memes.
Okay.
Like remember Franklin the turtle? Like they had people were doing Franklin goes on the crusade.
Help me out. What am I missing that you might have tried? Like I know Google has Notebook LM. Have you ever tried that? The one that generates podcasts based on documents?
No.
Have you heard about this though?
No.
Like if somebody has, let's say there's a 30 page work document that you're supposed to read by Monday, people can plug in that, just attach the document. and then Notebook LM will generate a podcast with two AI hosts discussing the document. And they kind of make the way, I think the idea is it's supposed to be more memorable because you're listening to a discussion about it.
That's kind of repulsive to me. I don't have any desire to do that. I can read.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of any other. So I'm interested, and I haven't done this, but what I would love to do, and I won't. I will not do this. But I like the idea of loading yours and my voices into some sort of AI that, there are ones that mimic voices. I haven't used them myself. And just create a podcast that is you and me, but not really us.
Right.
I know you'd be against
deeply it. Deeply against it.
Or another idea would be me podcasting with a ChatGPT that has the voice of you. I shouldn't say ChatGPT, just any AI model. Yeah. I think there's a service called 11 Labs that does stuff with voices. I haven't really...
I hate that idea.
I won't do it. I've already asked you about it in the past. I won't do it, but I love the idea. I just think it'd be interesting. It's
gross.
Yeah. Okay, so you're kind of a general user, strictly at work, nothing at home.
Yeah, but let's again, when we say nothing, what does that mean?
I think more of like the higher level. I'm not talking about autocorrect or even Google Translate. The higher level, almost interactive things.
I know what you mean.
You're giving a prompt and it's creating something.
Yeah, the generative AI.
Generative AI, yeah.
Yes, I don't use that in my personal life.
Yeah, but at home it does come up.
At work.
Sorry, at work it does come up. You know, one of my biggest uses for it.
I'll tell you something I love for it at work.
Yeah.
I love the Teams transcription because if I'm in a meeting or can't attend a meeting, and then I hear, oh, these two people are, you can go pull that up and see in the transcription what they actually said.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one area that I haven't used a transcription very much. I've been on meetings where people have said, we're recording this, or do you mind if we record this? But I haven't used that feature myself. Okay. Well, good. I think we answered the question.
Why did
Ben start using AI? Pretty much because of work, but also because his personal definition has changed. It became more of a nuanced view of AI.
Well, and the world definition has changed.
Yeah, like you've said so many times, it's become a marketing slogan more than something that is actually explaining what it is.
Yes.
I when I think of AI, I think of the generative. I'm writing something to create an answer. Like I'm giving a prompt, and it's either it's the higher level,
right?
And you use that strictly for work.
Correct.
All right. Well, listeners, you got the answer. This poll won with 42%. So there you go. Well, we'll post a new poll soon. But for now, like I said, that's all from here. Go check us out, patreon.com/thesci-fi-christian. That's where you can see our episodes you have to pay for, but also that's where our polls are for free. So, Ben, any closing thoughts?
Nope.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.